And that was Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Teach Your Children Well. And I have on the phone somebody who has taught many children well, including me. Is this Dan Ellsberg? Are you there? Hi, Dan.
Yes, hi.
Hi, can you hear okay?
Yes, I can. I was a little quiet for a minute.
Great. Well, no one's ever accused me of being a little quiet, but there we go. So, Cows listeners, I'd like to let you know that we're welcoming Dan Ellsberg to the living room today. And as just about everybody knows, Dan Ellsberg is very well known for the Pentagon Papers. And I hope that before we get into more of a conversation, Dan, you'll let our listeners know a little bit more about what was the significance of the Pentagon Papers and how does that relate to today?
Well, it was a study, 7,000 pages, top secret, which I gave to the New York Times, which it was an internal Pentagon study of U.S. decision-making in Vietnam from 1945 to 1968. And it showed a pattern, not just in one presidency, Lyndon Johnson's, which had become well known for lying, actually, at that point, for deceiving the public about what they were doing. But it showed that that was a pattern that had gone all the way back to Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy, and that these four presidents had all deceived the public in much the same way about what their plans were in Vietnam, what they expected to achieve, what the prospects were that they were offered, which were very bad on the whole.
Right, and that it was a winnable war, right?
For what they were doing. Well, you know, it's often described as saying that the Pentagon Papers showed that the president knew the war was not winnable. That's not exactly right, because the Joint Chiefs were always telling these presidents, very foolishly, I would say, well, especially in the 60s, that the war was winnable if only he would do what they said, if he would put in 500,000 to 1 million troops and basically invade North Vietnam, hit dikes, devastate the country there, and risk a war with China. And if he were just willing to do that, they promised him victory, which I believe they would not have delivered on.
Well, we would have not.
The president was short of that. So what the Pentagon Papers did show was that no one told the president that either Kennedy or Johnson and later Nixon, that what he was doing had any prospect of winning, what he was prepared to do. And by the way, I do think that these presidents were right not to follow the JCS advice. That would just have made a much bigger and longer war and probably would have resulted in war with China with nuclear weapons.
And we might not be here talking right now.
That's right. The alternative, well, probably so. We would be, because in those days, Nixon was counting. He was making nuclear threats in particular, and he was not bluffing, I believe. But he was counting that the Soviets, who had, after all, split with the Chinese sometime, well, about that time, actually, seriously. But to a large extent, even 10 years earlier. And he was counting that they would not respond to a nuclear attack on China with a nuclear attack on the U.S. And I think that was a good bet. Of course, if it had been wrong, then, as you say, we wouldn't be sitting here. But probably the result would not have been world war at that time, but the devastation of China. And I'm talking here 100 million dead or much more. It would have been the greatest massacre and disaster, really, in human history.
Yes.
And that's something that he was not just risking and threatening. I think he was prepared to carry it out at various times. In fact, to get back to the Pentagon Papers, that was not demonstrated in the Pentagon Papers because they ended in 1968, the account ended. I put them out and I began to give them to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee in 1969, and they didn't put them out in hearings, as they initially promised. And then I gave them to the newspapers in 1971. So that was under Nixon, and the papers didn't actually deal with anything that Nixon had done. And for that reason, by the way, he wasn't unhappy to see the papers out. He didn't want the president of someone taking it on themselves to put out the documentation of those lies and risks and gambles that people were taking, because he was himself deceiving the public and was, as I say, making actual nuclear threats, which would not have been very widely supported if they'd been known, since they were so extremely reckless. And he did didn't want me specifically to put out information if I had more than was in the Pentagon Papers. And he came to know that I did have more. I had documents on his own administration. He didn't know exactly what they were. He feared that it was his nuclear threats. So he had to stop me, and he didn't have a legal way to do that. So that's another story. But when you're saying these, what was it? Well, no, I should go on.
It is the same story, really.
Significance was, it is the same story, because the history of the earlier presidents didn't have the impact that I hoped it would. It definitely did make people more disillusioned with the Vietnam War than they already were. But a majority already felt that the war was hopeless by that time, by 71, and wanted out. And it's just increased that majority. And Nixon was not delivering on that. He didn't intend to, and he wasn't listening to the public. So from that point of view, it didn't affect what Nixon actually did.
Mm-hmm.
But he was continuing to make threats that were, I felt, and which turned out to be hopeless in terms of getting compliance from the Vietnamese. He was effectively asking them to surrender their goal of a unified Vietnam under their control. And they weren't about to do that. So, in effect, he was prolonging the war in hopes that he would get that, this hopeless desire that he would get that. And people were dying on both sides, about 10 to 1 Vietnamese. But still, some 23,000 Americans died while he was pursuing this hopeless aim, while he was telling the public he was ending the war. And the public to this day has been incurious, oddly incurious, as to why it took him so many years and 23,000 American lives to end the war on terms that he almost surely could have gotten in his first month or two in office.
And why do you think people were incurious about that?
Well, it's strange. He was going down in the direction down of numbers of troops involved, and the troops were going down. After all, 30,000 died under Johnson, and only, let me get this right. I said 23,000. Better figure is 28,000. I'm sorry. About 30,000 under Johnson, and then 28,000, and yet he's described as ending the war. Right. Well, that's because he wasn't going in the direction of going down during that period. And losing troops at about the same rate as Johnson and Kennedy had when they were going up, Johnson primarily. So the public was oddly quiescent about that. And it's not to their credit, I would say. But as long as the number of casualties was going down rather than up, even though they were still quite large, the public kept the pressure off him to a large extent. Mm-hmm. And the anti-war movement didn't really succeed in its conscious goal, which was to get the war ended.
Right.
They did put a limit. They did contribute to his need to keep the troops going down. And let me say right now, by the way, I believe that President Obama is promising the public that he's getting troops out of Afghanistan in 2014 after the election. I don't believe that any more than I believed it from Nixon in terms of getting out now altogether.
So do you think there's some parallels between Nixon?
Oh, very much so. And Nixon and Obama and also Johnson and Obama. When it came to escalating in Afghanistan a year ago, more than a year ago, he had no logical, no national security basis for doing that. It offered no promise of any kind of benefit for the U.S. or for Afghanistan, least of all for Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And I didn't mention earlier, by the way, that in this process of getting troops out of Vietnam and losing 28,000 Americans in the course of it, he was killing well more than a million Vietnamese, paid a price for that policy.
And the devastation to the environment. And also, yes. Yeah.
The Agent Orange.
Well, we're still seeing the effects of that terrible
part. Here's something that's just almost unbearable. We use mines to a very great extent in Vietnam, and people are still, children in particular, are still losing their limbs in Vietnam from mines that were laid by us at that time, but also from the use of controlled fragmentation weapons, CBUs are called, little bomblets that rained down from the sky and had orange containers that look sort of baseball-shaped, filled with enormous numbers of particles that would explode. This is also true of a lot of our kinds of mines, to the same kind of thing. In either case, a very large number of them didn't explode when they came down. So they're there like mines, and all over the country. And children are moved to pick them up. This is not only in Vietnam, but elsewhere where CBUs have been used, and as by Israel and by other countries.
Right. With United States funds.
And they kill the children or they're maimed for life.
And we have to bear the responsibility, this country does, for... Okay.
Now, here's what I was getting to.
Yes.
The news in yesterday was that President Obama is opposing a treaty that has been signed by 111 other countries to ban CBU weapons. Ban them not only because they're used very heavily against civilians, but in particular because of this problem of, for decades after the war, of killing people, sowing death.
So why would he refuse to sign that?
Okay, 111. We're using them in Afghanistan and Iraq, and Obama is opposing that treaty. This is frankly one of the worst acts. I won't even make it of American. This is in the category of terrible positions for any country, any statesperson. I'm ashamed of my country for being in this position.
What can we do?
Well, on this point, this would be a good one to lobby and to make a noise to our congresspersons, our Congress representatives. This is absolutely unacceptable. By the way, now I'm not up to date on this, but I believe that we have consistently opposed the mine ban, too. I'm not certain whether we ever finally... Yeah, I am pretty certain we've never really changed our position on that. A Nobel Prize was given to, I think... I've forgotten her name, a group that lobbied and worked for worldwide for
the elimination
treaty
of
mines, and was widely accepted by the U.S. and perhaps a couple of other countries. And in this case, it's outrageous for Obama to be opposing this.
It really is. I was joking before we went on air and saying that that Obama is a very, he's sometimes very Nixon-like.
Well, in some respects, whether he would like to or not, in this current political climate, he could not take many of the domestic initiatives for the good that Nixon actually did. Nixon was far to more liberal, let's say, or to the left of Obama, but that's true of Clinton. It's true of all the Republicans.
Well, Nixon formed the EPA, right?
Nixon actually introduced the EPA, right, which candidate Rick Perry thought of as a government department the other night, and one that he was going to abolish.
Instead,
actually,
it was the Department of Energy, right?
But the Republicans do want to abolish it.
Right. They want to restructure.
Introduced by Republican President Nixon. Well, right. The other side is you couldn't almost imagine. President Obama even trying to introduce that today, he couldn't do it.
Right.
So in that respect, in domestic terms, Nixon's policy looks far better than Obama's in general terms, and we could go through quite a few aspects of that.
Yeah.
But it would also be better than Clinton, and it would be better than the Republicans.
Yeah. Well, when you did reveal the Pentagon Papers, I remember there was a quote that I had read about that you felt that it was right to try to expose the secrets of five presidents that they had withheld and the lies that they told so that we could somehow improve.
Well, the Pentagon Papers exposed the lies of four presidents, and I knew that the fifth was lying. And
uh-huh.
Pick up where you asked a question earlier. I hoped that showing this consistent pattern of lying, and for the reason that I want to give a reason motive here, each president feared being the one who would be stuck with losing Vietnam, knowing that it was going to be lost eventually, that we were fighting too many people in Vietnam, too much support for the cause we were opposing, nationalist cause. We weren't going to be successful, and someday we would have to get out. But each president said, not on my turn, not on mm-hmm. my tour. I'll pass that one on to somebody else. And he was prepared to send Americans over to die and to kill, to postpone that outcome. So what I hoped was that people would see a pattern here that was, in fact, being prolonged into the Nixon administration for a fifth president. Yeah. But really, people, here's another problem of the public here, of humans, I would say, they were so reluctant to believe that the current president, even if they hadn't voted for him, was lying to them right now or deceiving them as to what he was doing and killing unjustifiably and sending Americans to die unjustifiably and to their lives being wasted in the term that was used then in Vietnam. When I was over there, you talked about someone being wasted, and that was actually a very apt metaphor as well as an idiom. And they were being wasted. And the but the public didn't want to believe that. They didn't want to tell their fellow Americans who'd lost sons there, well, wasn't so many daughters in that day, that those lives had been wasted. No one wanted to say that. They say, no, good cause, let's keep going, let's not be a quitter. Let's not end prematurely, and so the war went on for 10 years.
And it's actually still going on.
It's going to go on in Afghanistan a lot. It's gone on 10 years now. It could easily go on 10, 20, 30 more years, especially because many fewer Americans are dying. From that point of view, you can say only so many Americans, only more than in Afghanistan.
Yes,
together. Actually, I was just thinking today, Nixon actually wasted more American lives than Iraq and Afghanistan put together. This is Nixon in his first 4 years.
Yeah.
And he killed more people than our presidents have killed in the last 10 years in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's a lot of people.
And there's more. There's the walking wounded, the walking dead, so many people from the Vietnam era.
And the people who will die for decades to come. From the mines, but in particular from the CBUs, from these little bomblets that we're sowing the country with.
And I'm thinking also of the anguish so many vets have, this being Veterans Day, so many people living with the anguish of what we call now post-traumatic stress disorder, where people are still living
shell-shocked, they called it.
Yeah, shell-shocked. And, it's a tragedy that goes on and on. You mentioned...
Well, today is the day, 11-11-11, well, 11-11, the famous day when the World War I won. And it wasn't known that then there was the war to end war.
Yes.
They didn't call it World War I, first in a series. But what I've been doing the rest of my life is trying to avoid World War III in nuclear terms. But in what used to be called Armistice Day, I was young enough when it was still called Armistice Day, and then Veterans Day. But people used to think about who was the last person to be killed, on that day. And actually, there was a lot of killing on that morning. The day was meant to end at 11 o'clock, and people kept firing and patrolling and killing each other right up till the minute. And people have asked, when John Kerry was a veteran against the war, when he came back before he was a presidential candidate, he said to the Senate, how do you tell a man to be the last man to die for a mistake? I think that was the way he put it.
Right.
How do you tell a man to be the last man to die for a mistake? Well, we don't know veteran, no soldier in Afghanistan need fear of that for a long time.
It's going to keep on going.
He or she now is not going to be the last person to die for that mistake of prolonging this war. It's going to go on for a long time.
It is. So in your experience as a vet, you were 3 years in the Marines, you were an officer, and then you were an analyst for RAND. How did you get the transformation to a peace and justice activist after being so embedded in a way?
Several things. First of all, like a tremendous number of people in Vietnam and most of the people I knew in Washington, back in Washington when I came back from Vietnam with hepatitis, that's why I left, most of them knew the war was hopeless at that point. It was not going to end and felt that it should end.
Mm-hmm.
And I was one of those. Really, that was nearly everybody who had been there. Some people still believe, well, there was a way to win it, but we weren't doing it. McCain still manages to believe that if they had bombed even more than they did, we would have won it. Well, I'm sorry, he was brave in bearing the torture and the burdens of his imprisonment in North Vietnam, but it was not a place for him to learn much about the war, and he hasn't learned anything since. He's greatly in favor of more troops in Afghanistan, and wanted to send troops in Kosovo and various places. He's wrong to think that that would have won the war. That, by the way, the bombing we did do was almost four times the total tonnage of World War II, and another four times would not have done it. So anyway, I had come to realize that, and that we should get out, and the question was, what do you do about it? And most of the colleagues of mine who felt that way, I have to say, did not come to feel that they had a special responsibility because of having participated in the war to help end it. In my case, I had the privilege of meeting people who hadn't been in the service and had refused to go because they could see, young as they were, that this was not a just war in prolonging it and that they should not be part of it. And they were prepared to go to prison. In fact, instead of even becoming COs or going to Canada or getting out of it one way or another, they challenged the war to say as strongly as they could, I won't go because it's wrong and I'm not going to participate. And so it was their example, really, that made me ask myself, well, all right, I think we should get out. I agree with these people. If they're prepared to go to prison, what am I prepared to do? Well, go to prison. I realized that, if that were worthwhile.
And you've been to prison, what, 60 or 70 times now, right?
Over 80 now.
Or 80, maybe.
I hadn't been at that time. And what the Pentagon Papers was seemed to be one thing that was worth doing, putting that out in hopes that it would make people realize that perhaps the current president was also lying to them.
And he was complicit.
It would prove that the first four had done that. And as I say, I that wasn't achieved. But in terms of the chance that it might help shorten the war, I realized I was ready to go to prison after all in Vietnam, like so many other people, hundreds of thousands. I'd risked my body, I'd risked my life when I believed that it was the right thing to do. And now when I realized that that had not helped my country, had not been for our security, and that it should end, should I be willing to do less, or was I willing to do less? Well, I wasn't. The example of these people was really what made me realize there was more I could do if I was ready to risk my career, if I was ready to risk. Mm-hmm.
And you did. I mean, you were on trial, and finally the case was thrown out.
Well, that, for various other things, I was risking my career. Any kind of speaking out did that if you were working for the government, even as a contractor. But in the case of the Pentagon Papers, I was charged with a possible 115 years. So with good behavior, I would have gotten out a couple of years ago.
But they threw it out.
The reason then that the trial was dismissed, we come back to where we started, was what was revealed, talked about in these grand jury transcripts. I don't know if I mentioned that.
They're the ones that just got released.
Right? Just yesterday.
Yeah. These are the Nixon transcripts.
Discussing the crimes he had actually committed against me. He didn't go into detail. By people who worked for him in the White House, who were nicknamed the plumbers, to stop leaks. And to stop me from putting out information on his nuclear threats and his plans to prolong the war, escalate, the aims he was pursuing, which were hopelessly ambitious, he actually went into my former doctor's office, psychiatrist's office, psychoanalyst, to get information that he could blackmail me with into silence. It's usually described as information he could slander me with. Well, that actually wasn't exactly what he was after. He wanted information he could threaten me with putting out, and that he could keep me silent if I talked. Mm-hmm. And then when he didn't find that in the psychoanalyst's office, and there wasn't any to find, he did a number of other things, including overhear me on wiretaps of Mort Halpern, one of his assistants, with a warrantless wiretap, which was illegal. at that time, and then brought people up to, quote, incapacitate me totally.
That means kill you, right? Used.
Well, the prosecutor said, you know, these guys, what they said was incapacitate you totally. He said, you have to understand these guys who all worked for the CIA never use the word kill. They say neutralize, they say terminate with extreme prejudice and things like that. But he felt they were to kill me. I think they were just to shut me up, actually. But and they backed off because they thought they were being set up to be caught and blamed. And these are the people who later went into the Watergate. So he then, and this came up in the transcripts, the grand jury transcripts, he then had to offer them, and some of them who were running them, Howard Hunt, former CIA agent, over $100,000, a lot of money, to keep them quiet about what they had done against me. And he explains that as his effort, as part of his effort to get the war over. Well, the war could have been over on the terms that he finally accepted, as I said, years earlier. He was prolonging the war. And he said, if somebody puts out information that leads to the death of a single American, that person should be in jail. And that's, of course, what Bradley Manning and Julian Assange are charged with doing with the WikiLeaks disclosures. It was said right away, this will put blood on their hands. Mm-hmm. People will die as a result of these disclosures. Well, that was not impossible, but and was a risk that perhaps should not have been taken in some degree. Yeah. And yet, years later now, the Pentagon has admitted no one has actually died or been harmed as a result, physically as a result of those disclosures. Fortunately, in my case, of course, from this history that was being put out ending in 68, no one was harmed. And he slides over the fact that 28,000 Americans died while he was putting out the war, and that's what I was trying to shorten. But finally, I can perhaps bring this together with your first question in this way. What I did was a link in shortening the war, it turned out, because his fear of what else I would put out on his threats.
On his Nixon.
And Nixon's.
Yes.
Led him to commit crimes which faced him with impeachment in 1974. And he, after my trial was over, ended in 73. But due to my trial, really, a lot of these crimes came out in the trial, in the courtroom, in the last month before the trial was ended for that reason, because of the revelation of these crimes. And that was fine for me, but the bigger effect was that it faced him with impeachment. In those days, a president being shown to commit crimes faced indictment and prosecution and possible prison, but in the first instance, impeachment. And these were a major factor in his impeachment hearings that led to his resignation.
And for that, we thank you, Dan.
Well, thank you. I think that without that, the war would have gone on for at least a couple more years.
And more deaths and more deaths, devastation.
And probably not too many more American deaths. Hundreds of thousands more Vietnamese dead from our bomblets, from our CBUs, and from our napalm, and from other weapons. And to the same effect that we have now, which is the Vietnam that we're trading with right now, that would have that Vietnam would have been postponed by a couple more years. So for those deaths, so. Actually, I come back to the WikiLeaks. Without the WikiLeaks having come out, that was a critical factor in the disclosure of not just the corruption in Tunisia, which the people there knew about, but the fact that the American government knew about the corruption and was still backing the dictator there, Ben Ali. And with this disclosure, was unlikely to be willing overtly to back a rebellion against him. That was a major factor in the nonviolent revolution that ousted Ben Ali, and that in turn was the immediate stimulus catalyst to the nonviolent sit-in in Tahrir Square in Egypt, which led absolutely miraculously, you know, from an earlier point of view, to the ending of that dictatorship. Now, mm-hmm. how that will come out politically, we don't know. How it will come out in Tunisia or elsewhere.
But or what about the United
States? The Arab Spring was due to these
guys. What about the effect that it's having in the United States?
Well, I would say the Tahrir Square in Egypt has been the model for Occupy Wall Street and Occupy D.C. Actually, there's a lot of places have been renamed Tahrir Square in this country, but there's a lot of people sitting in right now and occupying a plaza called Liberty Plaza, a few blocks from the White House. And so they took inspiration that things could happen if people actually didn't just do a one-day demonstration, that's what they learned from Egypt and Tunisia, but showed a greater determination, a willingness to suffer some hardship, as the weather's getting cold here, and to speak out about the injustice of what's happening here.
Indeed. So, Dan Ellsberg, you have spent a lifetime, at least an adult lifetime, of trying to eliminate the threat of nuclear war. And I'd like to touch on that a little bit before we end our conversation. Is there any difference that you see in terms of the threat of nuclear war now from, let's say, 30 or 40 years ago?
Here's kind of an unfortunate difference. First, of course, the likelihood of an all-out exchange between the U.S. and the former Soviet Union, now Russia, has gone down very sharply, unfortunately not to zero at all. And it's inexcusable that there remains a genuine non-zero possibility, small probably, but inexcusable, that these two doomsday machines that are poised to attack each other in Russia and the U.S. are still in existence. And that is very much a matter of U.S. policy. Soviets, certainly, and now the Russians, have proposed much greater reductions than the U.S. has been willing to match over the years. This goes back 15 and 20 years now they've been making those proposals. And we still, in each case, have the ability to cause nuclear winter with the arsenals that even President Obama, talking of abolition, is still maintaining and aiming at. But beyond that, there's always been the threat of first use of nuclear weapons. Now, when Nixon was making those threats, he had to keep them secret because the public would have strongly objected, partly because of their fear that it would lead ultimately to nuclear war with Russia. But in any case, he had to keep them secret, and he was afraid I would expose them. And he had to do crimes to keep me from exposing them. Now the threats could not be more open. Mm-hmm. In 2008, all of the Republican candidates, except Ron Paul, called for keeping the nuclear threat against Iran, quote, on the table. They were following President George W. Bush, who first used that term. All options are on the table, and when Bush was asked, well, does that include nuclear attack, he repeated very emphatically, I said all options are on the table. And that phrase has become a code phrase for nuclear threat. Well, Ron Paul said that, you know, that's appalling. What are we saying here? We shouldn't be saying that, and so forth. But the others all said that. So did the Democrats, the major Democrats, not Kucinich, not Senator Gravel, and I think not John Edwards, as a matter of fact, but Hillary Clinton and Obama, definitely all options are on the table, and Obama is still saying it. And this Nobel Prize winner still feels, I don't know whether he believes that. I don't want to believe that he believes it. I think he's just saying that the way presidents say things that they feel they have to politically. But what he's saying is that we might have to initiate nuclear war against Iran, against the possibility that they might have a nuclear weapons program, for which there is no solid evidence. The IAEA has just come out with inferences, some of which are very ill-based, that contradict the national intelligence estimate of last year and the year before, that they did not have a program or that there was no evidence of a program. So we'll see where that turns out. Yeah. But whether they have a program or not, the idea that we would initiate nuclear war, we would justify a nuclear attack against underground sites in order to forestall the possible addition of one more country to the nine that have nuclear weapons, is inexcusable.
It's insane.
And I must say he is responding to domestic political pressures at this time, realistically, but no president should be doing it. That's what they do. They still do it, and they definitely should not. And that's not going to change, certainly not just by congressional initiative, unless the public demands a change on that and says, no, that's not an option. Initiating nuclear war against a country that does not have nuclear weapons is not an option. It's not on the table. It's not legitimate. It would be a war crime, and the threat itself is inexcusable.
It is. And I want to quote, when you received the alternative, is sometimes called the Alternative Nobel Prize in 2006, the Right Livelihood Award from Sweden, I found while seeing about that award, you got it for putting peace and truth first at considerable personal risk and dedicating your life to inspiring others to follow your example. And I'm wondering if you've got some words to help inspire us in these dark days. As an alternative Nobel Prize winner, Dan Ellsberg, could you tell us some words of inspiration, please?
Well,
what can we do? What should we be doing?
I think we have a chance. That's my optimism. I know it's not going to sound wildly optimistic, but the fact is that the stakes are the survival of humanity. We're talking in the nuclear issue here about something that threatens to extinguish not just America and Russia, not just civilization, but the human species as a whole through nuclear winter, and most complex forms of life, mammals, primates, altogether, perhaps down to bacteria. It's, again, I keep using the word outrageous and inexcusable, and I know that can sound hyperbolic or rhetorical. It's not in my mind at all. It seems to me we have to discover in ourselves the realization that we as humans have no right to be making such threats and do not have to do it, and that we as humans do have the capacity for compassion and for foresight that we often act without. We can match these terrible threats that come out of our humanity also, I'm sorry to say. We can match it with these other possibilities that we have for understanding and for empathy and for realizing that humans are all one family. And in fact, life is one family. And that we don't have a right or a need and that we to threaten it or to end it. And that we as humans can reverse this course. We really can. And that even a small chance of doing it is worth our doing. It's worth spending our lives doing. It's worth it. And there's almost no risk to ourselves or our own career that would be too great, too excessive to take if we have a chance to speak up and to press our own representatives to change course on this as they should. I think there is that possibility. It's not impossible. And I wish I could say it stronger than that, but for me, that's enough.
That's great. Well, Dan Ellsberg, it's been a total honor and pleasure to have you here in the living room on Cows Radio, coming to little rainy Occidental on a Friday evening by phone.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
And I hope you'll come back, and I hope you'll come and visit us again. And thank you again. And if people have questions for Dan Ellsberg, please email me, livingroomlaura@gmail.com, and I'll get those questions to Dan and see if we can keep the conversation going.
Okay. Thank you so much, Dan.
Be well. Bye-bye. And let's go out with the conversation with Dan Ellsberg with a gentle anti-nuclear song. This one's Morning Dew by the woman who wrote it, Bonnie Dobson.